I'm Philip Gurevich, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, FM, AM, and WNYC.org. When Herman Melville published Moby Dick in 1851, his career was already on the decline. He received about $500 over his entire life for a book that would later lend its title to countless American eateries, a kebab restaurant in Tehran, and a brothel in the Belgian city of Ghent. Hart Crane called Melville a fabulous shadow, and for years biographers have struggled to find material that might shed light on his mysterious 72-year life. The acclaimed social critic Andrew Del Banco published Melville, His World and Work, with the chief aim of emphasizing the complex connections between the elusive author's writing and the intellectual and political context in which he lived and worked. His book, which is said to employ dramatic skill and genuinely synthetic powers by reviewers, is also just a wonderful piece of writing itself, and it's been published by Alfred Knopf. It brings Mr. Del Banco to the show today, and it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
We're here in downtown Manhattan. This is Melville country. This is Melville streets. One of the things you do in the book is to sort of situate Herman Melville very much in his place and time, and that's striking since he's a person who is so unrecognized in a sense and underappreciated then. What is it about particularly New York that you focus on that sort of, you say, really sparked some of his verbal liberation?
Well, you know, you say we're here in Melville country, and I think that's true. Of course, New York is very good at covering up all the traces of, or not all, but many traces of many important, talented people who've lived here, and Melville's no exception. And Melville was, one of his great gifts was covering his tracks. So he left behind very few letters, very little biographical data. So it's hard. It's, in fact, I think, impossible to reconstruct his day-to-day life here in the city, where he lived for three different phases of his life. He grew up here as a child until he had to flee with his father, who had experienced a business disaster and got out of town before his creditors could catch up with him. And then he was here for about 3 years after he got married, when he was still a young man. And then he returned to the city in later life and lived his waning years here. My sense is that, as you've suggested, Melville has made it pretty hard to situate him in any particular place in American culture in the 19th century. And I came to feel, as I was reading and rereading him and exploring the New York in which he lived, that he was much more of a New Yorker than we've perhaps acknowledged. It's not so much that he wrote about New York. He did a little bit in his great and haunting story, Bartleby the Scrivener, with that subtitle, you remember, A Story of Wall Street. But that I think the rhythm of the city got into his language. My sense is that he woke up as a writer, that he began to take new chances as a writer, that he opened his eyes to some of the uglier aspects of life, to urban poverty and to the desperate loneliness of people who live in the midst of the crowd on their own through his New York experiences. And I guess one of the things I've tried to do in this book is to return him to his native city.
And also it seems to bridge the gap, as it were, between the notion of Melville as a difficult high artist and Melville as kind of a populist, or the sort of person that people name bad restaurants after his books. You open the book quite wonderfully and with a lot of sense of fun, it seems to me, much the way he opens Moby Dick with all these quotations about whales and whaling for pages and pages. You have a Mad Magazine cartoon. You have New York Times editorials. You have the BBC News and the dinner conversation about Is Billy Budd a Gay Book from The Sopranos. The way that he's infiltrated the culture more recently, essentially you're saying, is also the way he soaked it up in his own time.
Well, it is an amazing phenomenon because, this is the proverbial genius unacknowledged in his own time. But the twist to it is that not only has he been recognized by, the arbiters of high literary taste and the professors and so on in the 20th century, but he's, as you say, infiltrated the culture, penetrated not just the national consciousness, but the world consciousness, I think, to a degree that certainly no other American writer, with the possible exception of Mark Twain, has been able to do. And I'm not sure I have an adequate explanation for this, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about. And I must say, putting together that section at the front of the book was a great deal of fun. I did it before Google was there to help me. So, you know, you just stumble on things. There was a period of a few months a couple of years ago where it seemed as if you couldn't open the newspaper without finding a Melville reference. One of my favorites was when the New York Times slapped Mayor Bloomberg across the wrist for what they called his obsession with the idea of building a stadium in Midtown Manhattan, and the title of the editorial was Mayor Ahab. And, you know, everybody knows what that means, even people who've never read the book. It means that they're calling him a guy with an idée fixe, with something on his mind that he won't let go of.
A pretty destructive one.
Yeah, I think the analogy is a little overwrought in that particular case myself, particularly since for some reason the editors of the Times decided to refer to the stadium as Mayor Bloomberg's white elephant of a stadium. I don't know why white whale wasn't good enough. But anyway, it's fun to trace out these connections. And in fact, since the book came out, I found a couple more irresistible ones that I'm going to try to sneak into the paperback.
I mean, you also bring up a lot of the political comparisons, the way that people often describe anybody who's an obsessive as being Ahab-like or it's his white whale. Do you think these things would have meant anything to Melville?
Well, you know, I think what we're really approaching as a topic here is the question of why did his reputation explode into prominence in the 20th century, and why had it been sort of dormant or latent in his own time? And you know, it's easy to invent hypotheses about that. I think there are a lot of reasons for it. He was writing about subjects that mid-19th century readers apparently didn't particularly want to read about, and he was writing about it in a language, in a sort of nervous, lofty language, as he describes Ahab's, that has more kinship with the language of the high modernists of the 20th century than the writers who were popular in his own time. But I think, and I'm certainly not the first to think this, that the portrait of Ahab as this eloquent, demonic figure who is able to turn the collective consciousness of this crew away from what they think they're doing, which is signing up for a voyage to catch whales and bring back the whale parts to sell them in market, to turn them from that into an instrument of his personal vengeance. That's a story which clearly in the middle years of the 20th century had, shall we say, a purchase on the public imagination that it didn't have in the 19th, because we were witnessing this happening in Europe, and we were witnessing the whole world turning into a conflagration as a result.
I'm Philip Gurevich, and today for Leonard Lopate, we're talking about the new book, Herman Melville, the biography by Andrew Del Banco. You can read an excerpt from his book in our reading room on WNYC.org. This is WNYC AM FM and WNYC.org, New York Public Radio. Tell me, throughout Melville's writing, there is a kind of growing, after the early adventure books and so forth, there's a growing fixation on very vast metaphysical questions. And you're describing how he came to prominence and exploded on the 20th century. You call Moby Dick a 20th century novel. Sometimes I feel like it's more modern than anything that's been written since. And it has that, he was reading Shakespeare when he started writing it. He obviously had the ambition to go right up against Shakespeare and match him for the sheer explosiveness of language. But there's also this constant fixation with what one would have to call religious dilemmas. The absence of God, the refusal to accept the absence of God, the inability to find anything but the absence of God, that keeps being something he's bumping into. And do you think that had something to do with his being almost too modern for his own time?
I do. I mean, to return to our friend Captain Ahab for a moment, you remember his great speech when he finally confronts Mr. Starbuck, who's resisting his demonic obsession. He says to Starbuck, if man will strike, he must strike through the pasteboard mask. And then he pauses and says, sometimes I think there's naught beyond. Sometimes, that is, I think that beyond the surfaces where the religious traditions taught that beyond those surfaces is the will of God, that the world is put together by an intelligent being with a purposeful mentality. that Ahab raises the hypothesis or the possibility that that's not so, that the world is actually a wasteland, to use the title of a famous 20th century poem. Mm-hmm. And Melville doesn't want to go there with Ahab. Mm-hmm. There are beautiful lyrical passages in Moby Dick and in many of his other works in which you feel that he's writing like a high romantic, almost pantheistic-minded poet who feels the world spirit or the oversoul, as Emerson called it, or God, to give it its simplest name, breathing through nature and infusing the life with inherent meaning. So Melville, there was a part of Melville that was a believer, but there was also a part of him that was a radical doubter. And he gave voice to both of those aspects of his sensibility. I think probably the most beautiful and poignant and penetrating thing ever written about Melville was written by his close friend Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Melville, as he always does, began to reason of providence and futurity.
And everything that lies beyond human ken, exactly. And Hawthorne goes on to say, I'm paraphrasing now because I don't have it in front of me, that he cannot get hold of a definite belief, but he will not rest in his unbelief. And that, I think, really captures it.
It's a journal entry that Hawthorne wrote after Melville came visiting him in London and in Liverpool.
Right.
And they take a walk in the dunes, and he has that incredible line.
Right.
And also says, and he informed me that he had pretty much made up his mind to be annihilated.
Right. We have to remember that, you know, this was actually before the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species.
Right.
And that although there had always been free thinkers and skeptics, a certain kind of underground atheist or agnostic tradition, America was a very theistic culture. And for a serious writer to put forward this possibility that there was no durability to the human soul, that we were just collections of biological material that had a short lifespan and then disappeared into nothingness, was not a message that readers wanted to hear at that time.
Well, and he knew it. I mean, he knew that he was, in a sense, writing about a blasphemer. And I mean, you refer to him at one point as the American Dostoevsky or an American Dostoevsky. And it seems like, again, that's the... Dostoevsky thought he was writing in a way that defended against the argument of a nihilist or that he was making a religious argument. But he was always sort of troubled by the fact that his devilish characters were the most strong.
Right, exactly.
And it's striking that when Hawthorne appreciated... he dedicated Moby Dick to Hawthorne, and Hawthorne wrote back saying what a wonderful book it was. And I think it was in his letter in response to Hawthorne that he said, I have written a wicked book and feel spotless as the lamb.
Right.
I mean, the contradiction is right there. What did he think was so wicked about it?
Well, I mean, I think this just about everything was wicked. I mean, to begin with, what he was doing or trying to do was to hold his reader's nose right up close to the ugliness and brutality of the world from which the, shall we say, the props of their genteel lives came from. That was wicked in the sense that it crossed a boundary. It showed them something they didn't want to see. I mean, one has to remember that many people reading that book, or those relatively few who read it, that is, were reading it by lamps that were burning whale oil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before the discovery of petroleum in 1859, whale oil was a really important commodity in the culture. It was for illumination and lubrication, and the parts of whales, the hoop skirts that ladies wore to fancy dress balls were made with whale bone. The hair pomade that gentlemen put in their hair to keep the pompadour up came from the product of a whale's body. So one thing that Melville was doing in that book was to say, hey, I got news for you. This is where it comes from. But that's just the beginning of the wickedness. As I say, taking Ahab seriously, giving, as is sometimes said about Milton, Satan in Paradise Lost, the best lines to Ahab, the greatest mm-hmm. poetry to Ahab, was a daring thing to do. And there's also in that book, I mean, it's such a complicated book, so many themes crossing one another. There are political themes in that book. The fate of the black cabin boy Pip, who's abandoned in the nothingness of the open ocean, was also something that people didn't want to read about.
Though that's one of the places that he does acknowledge a god as in a way that suggests that he actually understands him, because when Pip is isolated and seems to drown, is about to drown, he says he saw God's foot on the treadle of the loom, right. And so his shipmates called him mad.
Right.
And he becomes sort of an idiot.
Right.
And of course his madness
takes the form of this strange way of speaking after he's had this horrifying experience of being alone in the midst of the ocean. And Melville, he describes it so brilliantly. At one point he says, "Mark," again paraphrasing, "mark how sailors, even on a dead calm day, if they jump over the side to have a swim, mark how close they hug the ship." Yep. Because of the terror of being alone in the midst of the sea. Mm-hmm. So Pip has this terror, and what happens to him afterwards is he simply conjugates the verb to look. I look, you look, he looks, we look, you look, they look. As if to suggest that what he has discovered through this experience is that there's only this multiplicity of perspectives. There is no central, true perspective that holds life together. So there's God present and there's God absent in the same experience. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to, you don't want to read that late at night if you've had a bad day. It makes it unlikely that you'll sleep well.
Yeah, I think that he touches on this again, obviously, in Pierre, when he has the extraordinary passage about the pyramids, and going, you know, "by vast pains we mine into the pyramids, by horrible gropings we come to the central room. With joy we espy the sarcophagus, but we lift the lid, and no body is there, appallingly vacant as vast as the soul of man."
Right.
And that sense that the discovery, he has a sense of delight, and then the despair is always at the kind of nothing,
right,
at the end of the...
And in Pierre, it's always struck me, I'm not sure I put this down in the book, I can't remember, but it's always struck me that as serious and terrifying as that passage is, there's also a certain kind of hysterical slapstick quality to it, almost like a Mel Brooks movie where the explorer, after, you know, years and years of striving, gets to the bottom of the pit and discovers that there's nothing there. So Melville had this kind of macabre, dark, call it 20th century humor as well.
I'm Philip Gurevich, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking with Andrew DelBanco, the author of the new biography of Herman Melville. We'll be back. We'll be back after a little break. I'm Philip Gurevich, here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. I'm speaking with Andrew DelBanco, the author of the new biography of Herman Melville, about his subject, Herman Melville. And there's a sort of, you sort of point out that people have this temptation always to divide Herman Melville's life into the, you know, before and after Moby Dick. Could you, and why would one resist that temptation?
Well, there's, of course, some truth to it in that it is the peak performance of his career. But on the other hand, you don't want the brilliant glare of Moby Dick to make it impossible to see the other great achievements of his life. And, you know, in that decade following Moby Dick, when I think he was in some ways imaginatively exhausted and also disappointed, deeply disappointed by the public reception, he did summon his powers and wrote some astonishing short works, which were published in the leading literary journals of his time, including that great story, Bartleby the Scrivener, that sort of a high school set piece now, so it's probably the one thing by Melville that most people have read. But it's just an amazing story about human desperation. And also an amazing literary performance when you consider the difference in tone and voice between the narrator of Moby Dick, with his exuberance and joyfulness and adventurousness and "I'll try anything once" attitude toward life, and this very cautious, nervous, constricted narrator of Bartleby, the lawyer into whose office one day this cadaverous young man walks and transforms his life by facing him with the problem of where does our responsibility begin toward other people and where does it end. So that's just one example. There's also the great novella Benito Cereno, which is Melville's most direct statement about slavery, and a beautiful series of sketches called the Encantadas. So I wanted to be sure that those works got their due.
And Billy Budd.
And Billy Budd at the very end of his life, which is in some ways, I think, as great a masterpiece as Moby Dick. It's in some ways an unbearably sad story, and I found it very hard to write it at certain points in the process. This, we begin with a young man who feels that he can achieve anything with this large sensibility. He says in Moby Dick, "Give me Vesuvius's crater for an inkstand. Give me a condor's quill, to write with." And you watch this sensibility on the decline throughout the 70 years of Melville's life. So it's a sad story filled with personal tragedies, the deaths of both of his sons who predeceased him, one of them most likely by suicide. But there's also the triumph of this great work at the end of his life that was his first return to prose, as far as we can tell, after many years of staying away from prose narrative, and was left in manuscript at his death. His wife kept the loose leaves of the work in a tin bread box. And when visitors would come to the house, as the interest in Melville began slowly to grow after his death, she would sometimes take out a page and say, "This is what my husband was working on when he died." And then it was actually a Columbia professor, I'm happy to say, since mm-hmm. that's where I work, who brought out the first published edition of Moby Dick in 1920. Of Billy Budd in 1924. And that really triggered the revival of interest in Melville's whole career. So it's a terribly sad story, but it's also one of artistic triumph.
He was pretty much of a loner. I mean, he had this appetite for human company, one feels. He liked the whale ship. He writes of friendship with a kind of uncommon attention and passion. He's quite free with it. There's obviously been a lot of criticism in the literary criticism sense, trying to analyze the homoerotic elements of it, but there's just this closeness with his shipmates, with Queequeg. There's a kind of egalitarian spirit, too, and, bringing in Queequeg and saying, what is he but George Washington, cannibalistically developed, right. Sort of putting everything in its mirror that way. And yet he seems to have been deeply and totally alone in some way. Hawthorne was the one person he thought of as a genius on his own sort of level.
I think that's true. And, I tried in my book to avoid any easy psychobabble type analyses using, modern terms like manic depressive or bipolar. But they're kind of irresistible when you spend time with Melville. I think it's pretty clear that he was a person of radical mood swings. Sometimes he was the life of the party. You get us there few hints, few letters that survive by friends of his that suggest what a great storyteller he was. And he clearly liked to drink, probably excessively at certain times in his life. So he was a sociable creature in that sense. But you also have the feeling, as you've just suggested, that he was someone who, and this is part of the pain of it for him, he knew he was a genius. And he was also a patriot, so he loved America, and he imagined, the way Whitman did, that his genius would be embraced by his country.
America would love him back.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And it didn't. And I think he, although he was a great Democrat in some respects, he also felt that, frankly, there were only a very few people with whom he was really capable of having an equal conversation. And, Shakespeare was one of them, but he was dead. Hawthorne was another. So you do feel him withdrawing into a sort of circle of one. As he gets older, there's a...
And then it gets spiteful, though. I mean, they did not stay as close over time as...
Well, that's an interesting, you know, there's been a lot of speculation that there was some kind of break in their friendship and that something happened between them that angered Hawthorne or vice versa. I'm not sure I think that's true. I mean, I think people, you know, the cliche is drift apart. They had different lives, lived in different places. And in fact, when Melville goes to see Hawthorne in Liverpool in 1856, as you've mentioned, there's a deep bond still there between them. And there's a suggestion, a little hint in one of the family letters that when Melville heard the news of Hawthorne's death in 1864, he was very, very shocked by the reality of that. I'm not sure. I'm not of the party that believes that there was some deep, dark, secret rupture between the two of them.
But he was jealous of him.
I mean, think there was, well, as in every, you know, great literary friendship, there was rivalry as well as mutual appreciation.
Right. I mean, first he says, in a sense, like, I want to write Moby Dick to be in that circle of geniuses together with him.
Right.
And then later, when Hawthorne's having successes and Melville's being ignored, he sort of, there's a letter that you quote from where he's essentially saying, oh, everywhere I go, I hear Hawthorne's name.
Right, everywhere.
Hawthorne and the
kid on the corner is selling your book, and I came home and my wife had just bought a copy. And, you know, the overt message is congratulations. The covert message is
ouch.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Now, all of that is true. And one of the challenges in writing this book was to try to pull some of this human drama out of a very limited body of material, and I don't know if I was always successful, but that the few letters of Melville's that do survive are so rich, so filled with mood fluctuations and intimations of deep thinking that, you know, you could write a whole book on just the letters between him and Hawthorne. You know, there's a moment at the end of Melville's life, again, when his reputation was just beginning to come back. He was invited to join the Century Association, the well-known Midtown literary club. And in fact, they had made a special category for writers because they figured, probably rightly, that many writers couldn't afford the membership dues. And apparently Melville first accepted and then had second thoughts and wrote a note in, which doesn't survive, but there's a reference to it, saying, you know, my nerves can't stand the socializing anymore, thank you, but rather not. And you get the feeling in his older years that he spent a lot of time walking around the city by himself, long walks, but mostly by himself.
I'm Philip Gurevich here for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Andrew DelBanco about the subject of his new biography, Herman Melville. This is WNYC AM/FM and WNYC.org. And that isolation was mirrored by his job. I mean, by the standards of even a very unsuccessful writer, he led a pretty weird life. His milieu was the Customs House.
Right.
You said it was a $4 a day job or a $4 a week job.
Right. It's really unbelievable. I mean, again, I guess it's
they made him take handwriting lessons so he could get a better so he could get a pay hike.
Right. He was all his life he was worried about his poor penmanship, and that was apparently an inhibiting factor in his prospects for promotion. But it is an amazing thing to think about, that this great literary genius would put on this sort of quasi-military uniform every morning with the brass buttons and the Navy-style coat and go to the piers on the Hudson River, and where he had a little shack for an office, and go through the bills of lading and the cargo lists and check off the goods and make sure that the runner to the warehouse had come and picked up the right consignment and so on. This is what he did with his days. And then he would go home and write poetry in the later hours of the day. And then eventually, because of an inheritance that his wife came into, he was able to quit the job. And that's when the fires of desire to write prose again began to be rekindled, and Billy Budd was the result.
So a little bit of cash went a long way. I mean, he had a brief career, I don't know how brief, a year or two, where he went out on sort of the equivalent of a book tour, but public speaking.
Yes.
And he had these two pat lectures, and he would kind of...
Right.
It sounds completely grim.
Right. He tried to turn this his experiences in the South Seas and his journeys through Italy and Greece into lecture topics. And, of course, in those days, you know, every self-respecting American town had a lyceum or a lecture venue where people like Emerson would come, and if you were in demand and you were willing to travel a lot, you could make a reasonable living that way. Melville never cut the mustard as a lecturer. He would mumble, and his words would disappear into his mustache, and he was an utter failure as a public speaker. I mentioned before, it's a sad story in some respects.
And yet out of it came this sublime work. I mean, the comparisons to Shakespeare, it's probably the only writer I can think of where it's not hyperbole. I see you brought, you're carrying Moby Dick with you. Is there something particular from it that you'd like to read from his work to give us a sense of what it is?
You know, I think since I've been talking about the sadness, I want to read my favorite passage. It's nothing in this book can be said to be representative because there's so many different voices in it. But this goes back to what we started talking about, Melville the New Yorker. This is a passage about Nantucket, because Nantucket plays a role in the story. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, why do biographical criticism? One way to answer the question is to say, well, it helps to know that when Melville wrote this, he had never been to Nantucket. He went there for the first time a year later with his father-in-law. So here's his description of Nantucket, and this to me is a New York voice. Nantucket, take out your map and look at it. See what a real corner of the world it occupies, how it stands there way offshore, more lonely than the Eddystone Lighthouse. Look at it, a mere hillock, an elbow of sand, all beach without a background. There's more sand there than you would use in 20 years as a substitute for blotting paper. Some gamesome whites will tell you that they have to plant weeds there. They don't grow naturally. That they import Canada thistles. That they have to send beyond seas for a spile to stop a leak in an oil cask. That pieces of wood in Nantucket are carried about like bits of the True Cross in Rome. That people there plant toadstools before their houses to get under the shade in summertime. That one blade of grass makes an oasis. Three blades in a day's walk a prairie, that they wear quicksand shoes, something like Laplander snowshoes, that they're so shut up, belted about, every way enclosed, surrounded, and made an utter island of by the ocean, that to their very chairs and tables small clams will sometimes be found adhering as to the backs of sea turtles. And after that, what I think of as this great riff in which he just takes off on every idea that comes into his head, describing a place that he's never been. He ends it with this wonderful sort of deflationary sentence. But these extravaganzas only show that Nantucket is no Illinois. It's such a wonderful passage, and I think it gives you a little bit of a feeling of what it must have been like to sit around over a drink with Melville late at night and listen to him just take off in the storytelling mode.
I suppose if you'd lived a little bit longer, you'd probably have a recording of his voice. Are there accounts of that? I mean, do you think he spoke with a New York accent?
There's some hint that that may have been the case, but I'm not enough of a linguistic historian to have ventured down that road. I have, frankly, no idea what he sounded like.
Yet his hometown news sheet, the New York Times, couldn't even get his name right in the obituary?
That's the story. Yes, it's true that Melville died pretty much in total obscurity. I would like to believe that he knew that he would be remembered, and he certainly has been.
He wrote fast.
Well,
when he wrote.
Yeah, you know, it's one hears it said of Mozart that he couldn't write the notes down as fast as they came into his head. My feeling is that there were moments, not always, but moments in Melville's career when that was true of him. He says, in fact, in a letter to one of his New York literary friends when he's writing Moby Dick, he says, you know, could you send me 50 fast-writing youths because, and I'm paraphrasing again, I've got so many ideas for books that I can't get them all down on paper fast enough. And you, in a passage like the one I just read where the images just come pouring out, the toadstools and the using the sand instead of blotting paper, and so on, toadstools as umbrellas, you get the feeling that, you know, that this is a Mozartian imagination at work.
And this was clean? I mean, have you seen manuscript pages? Do they exist? Did he cross out? Did he
rewrite? There's no manuscript of Moby Dick surviving. There is a fragment of the manuscript of his first book, Typee, which is now in the New York Public Library. He was a reviser. So it's very hard to reconstruct the process by which he wrote Moby Dick, but I'm certain that there were periods of time when he was, as he put it himself, in a mesmeric state, just sort of he and his muse locked together in something between combat and love.
Well, I'm Philip Karevich. I'm sitting in here today for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with Andrew Del Banco. His new book, Melville, His World and Work, is not only a moving and wonderful life of our great writer, but it also sends you tearing back to your shelf to read Melville again. And that's a great gift. This is Philip Karevich on the Leonard Lopate Show. The book is published by Alfred A. Knopf. And thank you very much for coming in today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
On tomorrow's show, we'll get an update on the conflict between Eritrea and Ethiopia on our regular underreported feature. Also on the show, a new documentary about the economic reasons we go to war. Plus, a look at the professional and personal life of photographer and model Lee Miller. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English and Brenna Farrell. We had help today from Blake Nishik, Barbara Kahn, and Isha Sabatini-Sloan. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Philip Karevich, in for Leonard Lopate. See you tomorrow.